Okay. All right, Rabosai, let's start. On the board, I have the Shalshelas of Chasidus. What I mean is, there you have the Baal Shem, who lived till 1760. He had one and only one follower, meaning everything then went to the Magid Mimezrich, who outlived the Baal Shem by 12 years. Okay? Now the question becomes, what happens after the Magid? You could have either, as we had before, one Rebbe who controls all of Chasidus, or it could splinter into many, many groups. It splinters into many, many groups. This is what's referred to as the third generation of Chasidus. Again, the Baal Shem, the Magid, then you have Rav Menachem Mendel Mivitebsk, Rav Levi Yitzchak Gradishev, Rami Mikarlin, a whole bunch of others. And of course, you have sort of, as their younger colleague, a person named Rav Shneur Zalman Miliadi, who lived until 1812. Now, it actually works out nicely that it's Yad Kislev, or it was Yad Kislev yesterday, and everybody went to the thing last night, and so everybody's into Rav Shneur Zalman Miliadi, who we're going to discuss today. Okay? He's also known as the Baal HaTanya. He's also known as the Admor HaZaken. He's also known as the Alter Rebbe. He's got a lot of names, but they're all the same person. Okay? Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. Okay. He's born on the 18th of Elul in 1745. Why does that matter? Well, you wouldn't know this on your own, but the 18th of Elul is also the birthday of the Baal Shem Tov. Cue music and things like that, because this is, you know. Okay, exactly. Okay. Yes.
So I think I missed it. What was the Shneur Zalman connection?
He's part of this group.
He's just one of the four?
There's many more than that. I just put a few there and then some extra lines to let you know. I just got tired of writing. Okay? But he's the next gen. He's considered to be the third generation of Chasidus when it splinters. Okay? Now, there's different stories about his parents. We'll go with the one that says that they were already secret Chasidim. They're what's called Nistarim, meaning there was huge opposition to Chasidus, as we've already discussed. So people who were authentic followers of the Besht were really careful that other people not know who they were, because otherwise they'd be in trouble. Okay, fine. He grew up with money, meaning his parents were well off. He was a genius. Okay, in all the ways that a person could be a genius, he was a genius. He wrote Sfarim as a kid. He did all these incredible things. When he was 15, he married somebody named Sterna, the family was a rich family. They lived in Vitebsk, where he lived, and his life was set. And basically, he didn't have to work. He could learn for the rest of his life. He could live a life of great luxury, but he didn't. Okay, at the age of 20, he decides to leave home and go on some kind of journey. He wants to find himself. He's not a lost soul, God forbid, but he's looking for something deeper in his life. Okay? So if you live in Vitebsk, you're a frum person, there's only two places you could go. You could go to Vilna and be a Talmud of the Gaon, or you could go to Lezhensk, or you could go to Mezribiz and be a Talmud of the Magid. Okay? And the quote is that Rav Shneur Zalman said to himself, I already knew how to learn, but I didn't know how to daven. So he went to Mezribiz to be with the Magid. Okay, first of all, it was at huge personal cost. Personal cost because his father-in-law cut him off, no more money, and actually tried to get his daughter to divorce him because he was a chassid. And it was like being a conservative Jew or Reform Jew, or, you know, it was unacceptable. And he had to live with that. Okay, he became part of this circle of Talmidim, of the Magid. Okay, was he the smartest of the circle? Maybe, but it's none of our business. But he's part of the inner circle. Okay, when he returned home as a full-fledged chassid, he was persecuted and eventually had to leave. There were at the time extremist Chasidim who picked fights with Misnagdim and extremist Misnagdim who picked fights with Chasidim. Rav Shneur Zalman really, really, really tried his best to bring peace between them, but it didn't work out. The Magid sent him on a mission to see the Vilna Gaon, right, to try to see if they could work something out. The Vilna Gaon was obviously the strongest opponent of Chassidus. So there's two versions of the story. There's the more accepted version, which is he went with Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, and the Gaon wouldn't see him. There's the version that we believe, because it's the Rav story. I heard the Rav tell the story in which he said, like, it's not just some story in my family. He said, my father of Moshe heard it from Rav Chaim, who heard it from Rav Chaim Volozhiner, who heard it from the Gra himself. Okay, I may be skipping a level in there, but it doesn't matter. You know, he said it wasn't just Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. He also took with him Rav Levi Yitzchak Mibarditchev. And he said they got there. And again, like the Gaon learned in some room upstairs from the Beis Medrash. And so they got permission and they knocked on the door. And he says the Gaon kind of like looked through a keyhole and saw Rav Shneur Zalman Miliadi, the Balatanya, who, if you've ever seen a picture of him, has extremely mesmerizing eyes. He really does. Like, you could go on the internet, you'll see it. And he said the Vilna Gaon climbed out the window and ran away. Literally. He said he was so afraid to meet Rav Shneur Zalman and be mesmerized by him, and he thought he might, like, back off his positions. So he literally ran away. Now, it's interesting, you know, the Rav tells the story. The Rav is a misnagid, although he has, you know, some Hasidic leanings. So it's like, it's an embarrassing story for the Gra, but that's the story that he tells. Okay, first thing, the Magid asks Rav Shneur Zalman to update Shulchan Aruch. Okay? No one asked me to update Shulchan Aruch. Like, you mean, he's an incredible Talmud Chacham, and he thinks it needs to be updated. This, of course, becomes what? No. Shulchan Aruch Harav. Okay? Now, for some reason, I couldn't figure out how this is. Most of it is lost. Okay? But we have chunks of it. And for Chabad Hasidim, it's the bottom line. I mean, the Shulchan Aruch Harav is the halacha. For the rest of us, it's a very, very important sefer. It's, again, it's not a Hasidic sefer. It's a halachic sefer. Written by, by one of the great Hasidim. But you can see in the Sefer what an enormous Talmud Chacham he was. And he really was. Okay. Next. In 1772, the Magid passes away. Okay, Rav Shneur Zalman is, can we figure out how old he is? He was born in 1745.
27.
Huh? 27. Okay, so he's a kid. So he's not really in line to be like the successor to the Magid. There are older people than him. But what happens is as follows. It's a strange thing. Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk is kind of the senior member of the group. And he would have been the next Rebbe, let's call it that. Most of you never heard of Rav Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk. You know why? Because he made Aliyah. That's what happens to people who make Aliyah. No. He made Aliyah with a bunch of his Hasidim. But it was pretty much impossible in those days to make a living in Israel. So he made a deal with Rav Shneur Zalman, who very much wanted to go with him to Israel. He made him stay behind, and he became like, I don't know, the fundraiser to send money to Israel to support these people. Okay, but, you know, you're not just talking about the age before the internet and WhatsApp. You're talking about the age before the telephone, right? There was no way to really, you know, for Menachem Mendel to remain the Admar over all these people who never see him and have Rav Levi Yitzchak sort of be the go-between, it just didn't work. And Rav Levi Yitzchak more or less became the Admar because there was no one else there. He founds a thing called Chabad. What does Chabad stand for? Right. All of them, you don't have to know the difference between Chachma Bina Vadas to understand that there's an intellectual emphasis here. Right? Chachma Bina Vadas, it's not that he rejected emotion. He didn't reject emotion. He was a very emotional person. But the way I see it is you have Chasidus and the Besht and the Magid being all about, you know, D-Book and Dveikos and feelings and things like that, all of which matter very, very much. And now you have Rav Shneur Zalman who's going to move it back from being, you know, some emotional, spiritual movement to being something close to the center, something based in intellect, but intellect that leads you to deep emotion. Nevertheless, it's intellect, it's not emotion. Or the way I see him, he's kind of like the anti-Rebbe Rebbe. Like, he didn't like his job. He thought his job was unnecessary, but he was really, really good at it. So let's discuss Chabad for a second. Okay, Chabad becomes very popular, and Rav Shneur Zalman is seen as the leader of Chabad because he was. And not just the leader of Chabad, but the leader of Chasidus. There are plenty of leaders of Chasidus, and there was a lot of fighting within Chasidus. We'll come to that at the end. But he was seen more or less as a successor. There are three small towns near each other, which you should know about. One is Liozna, one is Liadi, and one is Lubavitch. Eventually, they all land up in Lubavitch, and that's where it gets its name from. But the real name is Chabad and not Lubavitch. Okay, the first thing he does is he sets up a real organization, which I think is still true in Chabad nowadays, meaning one person can't run such a big thing. So he has people who are in charge of different regions and different shuls and gabbaim and all things like that, much like, you know, not in your lifetime, but in my lifetime, you know, the Lubavitcher Rebbe had shlichim and had all, you know, the organization is much too big just be led by one person, okay? Even that he felt was too much for him. And so he made takanos, and you can look them up. They're in books in the library. Then, you know, you can see it. He basically limited people's access to him. And this I understand. Meaning, if you sit there all day and people show up and tell you their problems, and, you know, God forbid my wife is infertile and this person has cancer, it wears you out. You know, it's really, really hard. And I'm not saying he didn't love his Hasidim, but I'm saying it was too much for him. And so he came out with a series of takanos that basically prohibited people from coming to see him. What are they? So first, you could learn a lot from the takanos. First of all, again, we've spoken about what Hasidus was like and what the davening was like. He basically said, all of my Hasidim have to daven in shul and have to daven at a regular minyan. There are two minyanim they can go to. They can daven vatikin, or they can daven at 6:30. Okay? Those are the two choices. So when you think about, you know, nowadays, what time do Lubavitchers daven? You know, let's just say they've moved pretty far, you know, from where they started at the beginning. Next thing, these are just the ones I highlighted, but there's so many. Next things, there's no talking in shul. There's no walking around in shul, right? Again, early Hasidim did all kinds of crazy things in shul. They walked around, they ran around, they somersaulted, they did all these things. Not for him. Okay. Next, any Chassid who wants to publish anything, it has to be submitted to him for review. It wasn't such an important takana because it wasn't like things were getting printed all the time like nowadays. But he didn't want anything going out that wasn't reviewed for him. And then the main thing is, you can't visit him more than once a year. Okay, you know, that's it. Because otherwise it's too much for him. He had gabbaim who were in charge of every shul. And they ran it. And they stopped people. Now, interestingly, this all may have led to the publication of his most important work, which is the Tanya. Okay, the Bala Tanya wrote the Tanya. Okay. It's funny how that works out, but it does. Why did he write the Tanya? Well, if he wasn't going to let Hasidim come and talk to him all the time, he needed to give them guidance. And he gave them guidance in a book. The Tanya is, without exaggeration, the most important Hasidic work ever written. It's called as the Torah Shebichsav of Hasidus. Right, that's what the Lubavitchers call it, but most people call it that. It's made up of a bunch of different sections, Likutei Amarim, which are just things that he said. So he started publishing anonymously Likute Amarim in 1792. First, he didn't want them published at all. And here, actually, it's the Misnagdim that may have made a mistake here. Because he had handwritten pamphlets, Misnagdim often added things that, you know, were like wrong, that made him look bad. And so finally he got tired of that, and so he allowed them to publish 53 really short chapters, Is the Sefer. Now, what is the Sefer? So there's a lot there, obviously. We'll focus on one thing. It's not really, he didn't call it Tanya. What did he call it? Anybody know? Sefer HaBeinonim. Excellent. Okay. Now, let's talk about this for a minute. A Beinoni is neither a tzaddik or a rasha. Okay? He's also not something in between. So what is he? A Beinoni, it's a condition of ongoing tension and struggle, which is the very, very purpose of creation. Okay? Before I explain what it is, it's not like you want one side to win and one side to lose. Right? Okay, if you're a tzaddik and he's a rasha, so you want the tzaddikim to win. And you think of Beino, it's not what it is. It's finding an equilibrium and finding some kind of tension that you can live with. You're not going to resolve the tension. You can live with it. It's a dialectic at some point. Maybe that's why the Rav loved the Tanya so much, because it was a dialectic. It works for Brisker Lumdus. I'm not saying that's true. I'm just suggesting it. But what are the two tensions? The two tensions are the two different components in your soul. One is what's called the Nefesh HaBehimi, right? But again, it's more physical than it is. Like, Nefesh Behimi sounds really, really bad. Now, you know, your real Nefesh is better than that. Your Neshama is better than the Nefesh HaBehimi. It's true. But the Nefesh HaBehimi is important. It's eating food. It's doing things that matter, right? It's not supposed to be that the neshama beats out the nefesh ha-behemi, because then you'll die. So what is it? The goal is to bring harmony between two competing sides. It's sort of like, this is a very bad example, but it's the best one I could come up with. It's like midas ha-din and midas ha-rachamim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world in midas ha-din, and it wasn't going to work, so he recreated the world in midas ha-rachamim. So which one is it? The answer is, they both exist, and the world is a continuous tension between Midas HaDin and Midas HaRachamim. So says the Baal HaTanya, the world is a continuing tension between the Nefesh HaBehemi and the Neshama. And what we have to find is, instead of winning, what we have to find is a way to live with the tension. Okay? You know, the secondary message is that average people can live with the tension. It's doable. I'm ignoring, of course, like, when he says tzaddik, he doesn't mean like the winner of that fight. He means him, right? He means the Baal Shem Tov. He means the Mag. He means, okay, in Hasidic lore, you know, that's a different level. But we don't have access to that level. But we have access to, we are Beinonim. But again, Beinonim aren't average, and they aren't a compromise. They're the fulfillment of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants in the world, which is finding a way to live with the tension. Why does it help us? Well, first of all, it helps us feeling like hypocrites in Avodas Hashem, because we have both these sides, and we know we have both these sides, and therefore we live in that conflict. But we can still be Oved Hashem. We can still do really, really good things with our lives, even though we have this tension. Okay, this is important. We can do it. It's achievable by all of us. You just have to sort it out. Okay. Another aspect that connects us to Tanya. Originally, Chassidut was about Dveikut, right? Emotional connection to God. But the Baal HaTanya came along and said it could be done better through the mind, through intellectualism, which is the path to the inner heart. He really thought so. Intellectualism, and it's important that we say this here in our yeshiva and in other places, it doesn't mean without emotion, right? You want to feel things. Intellectualism might be the real way to get to emotion. If you think it through, if you feel deeply, The result is emotion, but it comes through intellect. Hamoach sholeit al halev is what the Baal HaTanya said. The brain controls the heart, controls emotion. It's all about the brain. It's not exclusively about the brain, but intellect leads to all the other things we want. Okay. After publication of the Tanya, it became really, really popular. Opposition to Hasidus really starts to heat up. It also didn't help that in 1797, after the death of the Gra, Hasidim were accused of celebrating. Now, it was on Sukkot, so they claimed they were having a Simchas Beis HaShoeva. Who knows who's right? Okay, so the fight intensifies. Now, somebody goes, and this is like a really interesting historical question, but we're not going to deal with it. Who turned the Baal HaTanya into the authorities? Okay, but somebody went to the authorities and told them that the Baal HaTanya was supporting the Turks, who the Russians were at war with. Now, why does it look bad for the Baal HaTanya, and why does it look like he's working for the Turks? Because he's raising money for Jews in Palestine. Jews in Palestine belong to the Turkish Empire. Okay, so technically speaking, it was true, even though that wasn't his intention. He's arrested, and he's imprisoned in a maximum security prison in St. Petersburg. It's hard to know why this becomes a huge deal for Hasidim. Okay, the Rebbe was arrested is a big deal. In the end, all Rebbes were arrested pretty much, so that's not a big deal. But this was a really big one. Okay, it was a traumatic time. He's in jail for 53 days. He's released on Yad Kislev, which is why Yad Kislev becomes Rosh Hashanah LeChasidus, because, you know, he's released. But what's really going on? So first of all, while he's in jail, it's very serious. They fast Bahab. Every Monday and Thursday they fast. No one's allowed to get married. Like, if you had planned a wedding already, you can get married. But otherwise, there's no getting married. They ate only basic foods. They basically, you know, lived in pain till the Rebbe was released. Now, why does Yad Kislev become this enormously big deal? And why is it now, like, such a big deal that it's celebrated in Yeshivat Har Etzion, let alone other places? The answer is because Hasidim saw the release of the Rebbe as a vindication of Hasidus. They basically saw it now as permission from Shamayim. They didn't think, and it's hard to know exactly what happened in jail. There are no records whatsoever of what happened in his interrogation. We know that he was interrogated, you know, maybe every day, all day, for 53 days, and whatever he told them worked, because he got out, completely out, by the way. Like, you know, no parole, thank you, I couldn't think of the word. No, you know, he's basically found innocent. Probation. Okay. Whatever it is. No, none of the P's, okay? It's, you know, nobody knows what he told them, but for Hasidim, what they saw, it was a victory of Hasidus in Shamayim. The way they saw it, in Shamayim, there was a court case for 53 days, whether the Baal HaTanya ate Hasidus worldwide. And the answer was yes, he could. And they celebrated it, you know, like crazy. Okay, another side point, but it matters in his life. Yes? I mean, on what really happened?
Yeah, like the Hasidim said, like, okay, after 53 days, there's this whole, like, bit in Shemayim.
Right.
Was he like, yeah, that's what happened? Or was he like...
He didn't stop it.
Right.
It's hard to know. Seven Rebbes later, was he in favor or against him being the Mashiach? It's hard to know. Okay? Now, there's a big war between Napoleon and the Tsar. And the Baal HaTanya takes sides. Okay, he takes the side of the Tsar. And it's a little painful to read, but he wrote a letter that survived. First of all, the taking a position on politics became like a hallmark of Lubavitch. Right? The first Rebbe took a position on politics, and after that, you know, till the last Rebbe, who took strong positions on politics, the West Bank, things like that, you know. Okay, but here's the quote. And this explains his position. Should Napoleon be victorious, wealth among the Jews will be abundant. Okay, you see, like it'll be good. But the hearts of Israel will be separated and distant from their father in heaven. He was worried about the emancipation. He was really worried what it would do to Frum people. But if our master Alexander will triumph, though poverty will be abundant, the heart of Israel will be bound and joined with their father in heaven. So basically, and the last thing is, the last line of the letter is, and for God's sakes, burn this letter. Okay, it didn't get burned because we have a copy of it. But the fact is, he basically backed the Tsar because life would be miserable for Jews if the Tsar won. He was against Napoleon because Napoleon would change the world and could change the world. It's painful. It's also painful that he's probably right. You know, Napoleon had some kind of messianic complex that was going to make a big difference. It was going to change everything. He was afraid that that openness and that freedom would be bad for Frum Jews. Whereas if the Tsar's a miserable guy and life's miserable under the Tsar. But in Anatevka and wherever these other places were, people were Frum. You know, they had no alternative. So they were Frum. He was afraid of what would happen if that changed. And, you know, part of his fear was seen. Okay, after his release from jail, Rav Shneur Zalman visits many communities to try to bring peace. It's not clear that he brought peace. It's probably more that Hasidim started fighting with each other. Like, really, really started fighting with each other in an ugly way. And so Misnagdim, like, they didn't really care to attack them anymore because they were doing enough of the attacking on their own. There was a period in Hasidus where Rebbes hated each other and were jealous of each other. And, you know, it happened right after the Baal HaTanya. That's something that Hasidim had to deal with. Otherwise, again, he was a magnetic personality. He was a genius. He really was the first person to try to put a form to Hasidus. You know, again, the Baal Shem didn't have a philosophy. As best I can tell, the Magi didn't have a philosophy. Came the next generation, in particular, the Baal HaTanya, and said, this is what I want Hasidus to look like. He wanted Hasidus to look more like Misnagdim, but not completely so. He wanted Hasidus to have an intellectual element. But again, the purpose of the intellect was to lead to deep feelings, was to lead to deep emotion. And I think to this day we believe that intellectualism can lead you to emotion and to dveikus in God. Okay, shkof. This afternoon, once